My name is Hannah Jenny. I'm from Cal State San Bernardino. I'm the moderator for this session. And our first speaker is Brenda Clark from the University of Hawaii. And she will be speaking on the documentation of sign language diversity in Peru.
Hi everyone, thanks for coming. So like I said, I'm going to be talking about, mostly based on my experiences of documenting sign languages in Peru and the diversity that I found. Okay, so a little bit about the language itself. It is an official language of Peru as of 2010, although as you can see a couple points later here, the documentation is just beginning. There's very little framework for actually treating the language as an official language equal to Spanish or even Quechua. This estimation of about 30,000 signers, that's based on the percentage of the population that is deaf. There's no real estimate on the number of signers because there are some signers that use ASL. There is a lot of variation to the extent that there are rumors that not all signers are actually using the same language. So there might be a couple of Peruvian sign languages in reality. As a couple of the other speakers have talked about today, this language is endangered. It's threatened by educational policies. There's a strict inclusion policy right now, which the Ministry of Education is very excited about. They see it as treating everybody as equals, no matter what kind of disabilities that kids have. They're included in mainstream education, but there are not actual accommodations that allow those kids to actually keep up with material. So that is something that's through language encouraging oralization instead of actual signing in schools and in the community. Different attitudes in different areas, which we'll talk about a little bit later. ASL and transmission, again, as some of the other speakers have talked about today. And documentation is just beginning. So this talk is about kind of working from the ground up. It's just me and a few other people who are really interested in this right now. Maybe some of you will join me. So this is a very kind of basic, we're at the basic level right now, basic stages, trying to figure out what exactly the situation is and how to help it. So my fieldwork, I spent 2 months last summer in Peru, time fairly equally split between Lima and Pucallpa. Talked to some linguists at the Catholic University, that's PUCP, in Lima. Some deaf leaders from the associations in different cities, the Ministry of Education, again, not super encouraging, and then a couple other researchers and educators there. And I was able to collect about 25 hours of actual interviews and data, mostly vocabulary elicitation. I'm going to talk about some of the methodology that didn't work, some of the methodology that worked, what I'm going to try to change when I go back in the future. So overall, as we were just talking about right before my talk, there's a lot of variation. Things like age, education, region, and even down to individual social groups, you get to a lot of different signs, which is very confusing for me. I have very weak ASL skills. Some of it is ASL, and I recognized a little bit of it. A lot of it is totally foreign to me. That was definitely a huge challenge. There's, as I said, influence for ASL, also BSL and LSC, Spanish Sign Language. And I found that, just going through very briefly, looking at a 100-word Swadesh list, looks like anywhere from 20 to 70% of the vocabulary is actually influenced by foreign signs. Again, right down to individual speakers using different signs, not a huge amount of consistency there. Also found that there are more positive attitudes toward indigenous signs in Lima, which is encouraging because I think that is a place where ideas can kind of spread from there, right? There's the head of all the deaf associations is stationed in Lima, so I think those attitudes might spread out and maybe start trying to keep ASL away. And there is definitely interest in the community, based on just people that I talk to, interest in documentation and education reform in the community. Okay. So main challenges, first of all, finding informants. There's what I call long distance networking, which is not something that I'm used to doing, and something that I had to kind of work around. There's not a lot of kind of online communication, which is what I was used to trying to look for. There's not a lot of networking through the schools, at least that I was able to access. That'd be something to look into when I have more contacts and I can actually use kind of liaisons in the future. There's some conflict between different groups you have to kind of navigate around. And interpretation is another issue. As I said, the language was just recognized 5 years ago as an actual official language, so the training programs for interpreters are in their infancy. There's a very small group in Lima. They already have established relationships. I had to kind of bring things to them. I couldn't find anybody who was interested in actually, you know, kind of traveling with me, kind of getting incorporated into my project. They had, you know, their own setup already. Lots of variation, as I already said, not only in the language they were using, but in the Spanish and the ASL that they could understand. So for communication between me and my participants, that was an issue. Educational background, attitude again. Another big thing that we're gonna talk about is elicitation. Again, this is kind of a slightly different method from languages that might have more of a background, more of a process, more of a grounding in education. For a lot of the pairs of us, for me and the speakers, we didn't really have a common language. And that's a huge problem when you don't have reliable interpretation. I had problems with consistency because I was approaching this from what I now realize is a hearing perspective, and from an academic perspective, which is not really appropriate for this situation. And then also abstractness, trying to get at some of those more abstract concepts that you can't just put up a picture and say, what is this? Oh, it's a dog. Okay. So some of the solutions, things that I found to be very useful in finding informants was to just kind of become visible in the community. I found a deaf association in Lima, and I just kind of went there and hung out. Was kind of in the corner for a while, trying to talk to a few people as they came in. And then after I went back a few times, and they said, okay, this lady is not going to go away unless we can talk to her. They finally got to the point where I could actually communicate that one of the interpreters came in, and I actually told her kind of what I was interested in, and she's all right, well, getting out here, I actually got to take a class there, which was great. Some of the most indigenous signs I think I got were maybe from that class. Hang out is my way of saying just, you know, be with the community. Not only, you know, show up places, but actually participate. I played volleyball, I played basketball, which are things I am not good at and have no business doing, but it really helps just my face to be recognizable in the community and for them to be a little bit more comfortable actually talking to me. Relax is my next thing. I was really worried. I said, okay, I have 2 months to do this, I'm here. And I tried to kind of schedule everything, but I realized that you just have to kind of go with it. And say, you know, schedules are going to be relative, you're going to stretch things, you're going to, you know, take days to do things instead of hours, right? So just, you know, just go with the flow. Show interest in tangible ways. That was something where I think when I actually took the class, I paid for it, right? I showed that I was actually interested in kind of investing time and money into the deaf community, and that was, I think, really helpful. They were a lot more willing to kind of help me out and introduce me to people and try to actually incorporate me a little more into the community after I had done that. Name dropping, also great. I found that if I could just remember names of people and say, oh, I talked to this person, a lot of they would recognize that and say, oh, okay, you do actually know some people, you have relationships with those people. And again, as I mentioned earlier, I found that you kind of need some kind of in. to actually contact some of the higher authorities, schools, and things like the Ministry of Education or the government. And I don't think that me as kind of an outsider just coming in and saying, oh, I'm a linguist and this is a really cool language and we should support it, and education might need to be changed a little bit. I think I need somebody with a little bit more authority, somebody who's a little bit more well-known in either the deaf community or just in Peru in general, to actually be able to talk to those authorities with authority. Moving on to interpretation, my first bullet point here is learn the language. That was my most effective strategy, was when I actually got to, when I got to Pucallpa, I actually lived with a deaf family, and through immersion, as you all know, it's a really good way to actually learn a language. I can communicate way better, can actually have a little bit of small talk with people when I would be introduced to them, instead of just saying, okay, yes, this is my sign name and that's all I can say to you, which was the case a lot of times. I learned that I should not expect to have an interpreter for elicitation. My original methodology was kind of a word list. I had some pictures for some items that I thought might not be familiar, but essentially it was, you know, Spanish words and what's the sign for this. I realized that does not work if you can't explain that in some other way, because a lot of the people I was working with would not recognize the Spanish words. If you could fingerspell it, that was a little better. But again, going back to variation, different fingerspelling methods in different areas. Okay, so I had to adapt, and we'll talk about more later about how I actually adapted the elicitation as I went to be a little bit more appropriate. I also found that I could go to not only interpreters, but educators. There's one man that I spoke to who had essentially started this kind of grassroots program where he would take kids after school, deaf kids, and actually try to help them with homework and kind of basic concepts that they were missing in school because they didn't have an interpreter to help them out. And he was a great resource just to ask about, you know, what are the kids saying today? You know, is this, I saw somebody say this, or somebody translated the sentence in this way, does that seem like something that is natural? Do you see people signing this way? And just to help me out with my lack of actual intuition in those kinds of things. I thought that friends or family members, hearing friends and family members, let me say that, might be very useful for interpretation, but it turns out that either they just kind of weren't interested and they would give me really loose translations, or just lose interest after a while and start doing other things, or they weren't quite as fluent in the sign languages as I thought they might be, as they kind of claimed to be. They could communicate, but they couldn't really explain things the way that I needed them to. And in some cases, I had kind of mentor-mentee relationships going on. So when I was talking to or listening from the mentee, somebody who might have still been seen as acquiring the language, the mentor, instead of trying to elicit, right, a response from the person or explaining, you know, the question that I was asking, they would just kind of give them the answer, and then the learner would just be repeating instead of actually giving. Maybe they had a different sign, maybe they had a different background, and that's why they were signing differently, and it was really hard to tease that out when you had this kind of answer feeding, as I call it. And support interpretation programs, that's another great thing that will be a little bit more important maybe in the future when I try to do more complex grammatical elicitation instead of just vocabulary, to actually have interpretation. Okay, variation, find out about the participant's background really, really early. Things like what kind of type of fingerspelling they're using. I didn't think that that was necessary after I had established, oh, this is a very similar system to ASL and I can get by. Not the case. Certain pairs, the sign can be a T or an E. Those are very important distinctions to know. and a couple other things like that. I found that I just had to use as many modes as possible to try to communicate, you know, drawings, pictures, gesture, charades, anything that I could find, and figure out what the participant was actually responding to the best. That was also something that varied a lot. It was also useful to talk to groups about variation, to ask them, you know, is this the only sign for it? Does anybody else use another sign? And that a lot of the time sparked a lot of really good discussion about what the variation was, what the regions were that seemed to have different signs, what the opinions were about those different signs. Found that if I framed questions as descriptions, as in, I'm gonna give you a picture and you should describe it, I got way better responses, way more confident responses than if I asked for, what is the sign for, right? It's not what is the right answer, right? As in, you know, give me the sign that you would learn in school, maybe, the ASL sign, but just how would you describe this? And I repeated several times, this was kind of became my mantra, was I like to see different signs, I wanna see your signs. So again, to kind of take the pressure off of giving me the correct or prestigious sign. Okay, for elicitation, come up with several things that seemed to work for the population I was working with. So the basic structure, definitely do the metadata interviews first, both for informational purposes or to figure out who you're talking to, and because that was a good warm up. It got people signing, got them used to you being there, used to the camera, and just got you used to their kind of style, what kind of answers they might be giving you. I shortened my sessions drastically. Originally I had it organized by semantic domains, but it was one kind of long PowerPoint and people just, they zoned out a little bit after a while. So I've limited it to kind of 11 to 35 items. I number them so that they know how many more they have to go, so they don't think that I'm just gonna stay there all day. Then they can also choose, because they are, these are thematic sessions. So they can kind of choose if they want to talk about animals or food or any of the other things, kind of basic things or opposites or something like that. Then I found that one video per session worked really well, because then you don't have the interruptions of kind of getting up and turning off the camera. You can catch those little discussions or comments that happen between items. And then I felt like it was more like a conversation. I was actually present there, interacting with them, instead of just saying, all right, let me record this. Made it a little bit less formal. Decided to remove any animation I had for things like fast and slow, so that it can be printable. So I found that the kind of laptop on a table format was problematic because of power. I didn't want to be using all these people's electricity, which is not cheap. And I couldn't do things like have it outside. People couldn't actually interact with the item. They couldn't pick it up and examine it a little bit more closely. So especially a problem for the group elicitations where I had people thought they were gonna knock heads. They would lean down to see the slide a little bit closer, and it looked dangerous in some of my videos. Okay, individual or group, that's kind of depends on the signers, how good of friends they are. If they're too good of friends, sometimes it's really distracting. But if they're just kind of acquaintances that get along, it works very well because they sometimes learn things about each other and have spontaneous discussions about that. And for now, even though this might be a kind of controversial issue, I found that my actually being there to discuss, to clarify, was really helpful, even though I am here in person. I think they knew that I was not super fluent in Spanish. They saw my struggles with some of the hearing people, and they knew that I didn't know ASL, so they weren't too concerned about really accommodating to my language. They just kind of tried to get me to understand in their language, which was great and very helpful for me acquiring it. So here's just some examples. I found that if I have many things, then it both is clearer and allows for some variation. They can give me different types of water coming out of the bottle, water kind of spilling or in an ocean, water in a glass. Be helpful. And then if they don't have those distinctions, then they just won't say them. Kind of out of time, so I'll go through this really quickly. Working on trying to establish symbols that I can reuse to help with the more abstract items. Giving sample answers so that they know if they're supposed to answer the question, if they're supposed to translate the question, how long their answer should be. Blah, blah, blah. I talked about stories and, you know, describe how to do this, teach me how to cook something. Okay, and then consent, I'm gonna just talk about a tiny little bit. Found that a discussion really worked better because if you just kind of tell them several things or give them a sheet, people often just kind of nodded along, and I got the impression that they really did not understand what I was doing and just wanted to agree with me. So I think that an actual discussion where you have some question and answer is really, really helpful. And hopefully you can get that interpreted. Okay, just some more examples, some of the kind of symbols that I would establish. And then in the future, I'm still doing a comparison of lexical, lexical items and phonetic features. There might be a variety. There are rumors that there is another variety of language in the Quechua speaking regions of Peru, which I'm really excited about. I really want to go investigate that this summer. And then just some more technical analysis and education materials, community projects. And this picture, so you're not wondering why there are random motorcycles on my slide, is because in Pucallpa there is this great work program where they pretty much all of the deaf population, I'd say 80 to 90%, are employed renting these motorcycles. And when I went to Iquitos and I was discussing this, we were talking about community projects, no idea that was going on in this area. So even though they have that network of deaf associations all over Peru, it's not quite as close-knit as you might expect, and not quite as collaborative as I would think would be useful, especially for things like this. Okay, so thank all these
people. We have about 7 minutes for questions.
Yes?
Just a comment, really. I think you're doing a great job. If I think back to when I started out, I mean, I had my first partner had deaf parents, so that's how I got into the community. And I was well known to the community before I started doing sign language research. So it was very, you're going into it cold. I think that's, you're doing a great job. And I think it's amazing the stuff that you're doing. Has nothing been done really on this sign language at all?
I couldn't find really, I found one publication that talked about the fact that it was a thing, essentially. And then there's one small project documenting kind of stories and a few other things. They weren't too clear to me on their exact methodology at the Catholic University in Lima. I found a researcher working on home signing, and that's kind of it.
Wow.
So yeah, it's kind of going in blindly.
Wow.
Could
you talk to me a little bit about the BSL connection that you mentioned, where you found some vocab that overlaps with, what was that?
I wish I had good examples. I don't remember right now,
right.
But there's, yeah. I would say about 20% seems to be cognate with BSL.
Any explanation
which may have,
how that ended up?
I think... we've actually come, I'm looking more into Spanish Sign Language, because that has a connection with BSL as well. So it might have come through that connection, as opposed to actually your BSL. But
wow.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
You're aware of the work that looks at cognates across sign languages and that talks about the fact that there's going to be, due to iconicity,
overlap
in any unrelated pair.
Right. I tried to not
right.
not count the iconic ones
right,
as common. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Do you know much about the history of things like deaf education
mm-hmm.
and other kind of deaf institutions and groups? Because I found in my experience working in a community, it really helped me a lot to understand
mm-hmm.
when the deaf school was established
mm-hmm.
and that helped me to understand the kind of variation that exists within the community.
Right, yeah, that's something that I really want to look into. And I said, I went to the Ministry of Education to talk to them, and that essentially, I thought it was going to be a conversation. It was a presentation to me about they're very proud of their inclusion policies. So I couldn't get into the schools. I couldn't get those connections when I was there last time. Maybe I can look into that a little bit more next time. But yeah, I would love to look into that as well.
Sorry, just to mm-hmm. relate to that. Sorry, is that someone else? The eight regions that we did, you were here for the presentation I did
yes.
on? Yeah. The eight regions, they were also the centres of, they were cities that had residential schools for deaf children. So we
okay.
knew that there was going to be dialect variation that had developed right. around those schools. So there were other places, there were more schools than there were other places, and I constantly have to deal with the fact that every time I go back to the UK, people say, why didn't you come to Liverpool? I agree with Ben that it's very important to find out about that history.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the only schools that are for deaf students are in Lima. That's the impression I got, that's what people told me. So yeah, I don't know if there's a history, if there were schools before this new policy or not, but yeah, I would love to look into that. Yes?
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's any presence and any type of deaf school or help within the Quechua villages, if you know of anything.
That's something to find out. Again, people, when I was discussing variation, they told me about this variety that may or may not exist, kind of mystery variety. Nobody seemed to know anything about it where I was, so I think I'm just going to have to go there and try to
So there may not be something
it.
Official going on, maybe something locally.
Right, yeah, I don't think it would be official, just based on the impressions that I got from the school system. Yes?
In the rural areas, you might also want to see if there are indigenous signing communities mm-hmm. where there are larger percentages of deaf people in village communities,
mm-hmm.
because I think in the mountains there will be some intermarriage, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
the same problem. I just went to Myanmar to start some research, and you know, there's basically one sign language in Yangon, one sign language in Mandalay, where they're separate schools for the deaf.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently, people keep talking about the rural areas, Kachin. Everybody's fighting now, so you really can't get into those areas. But people do report sign language, different sign languages there. So I think you should really
mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, great, thank you.
That's such a hot topic right now, of course, the village sign language stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about like indigenous sign languages that aren't institutional, that are like family grown languages or something?
Not necessarily family, whole villages. Use them. So, for example, Martha's Vineyard Sign Language, there's a sign language I looked at on Providence Island, where about 2,000 hearing people use it and 22 deaf people. So these situations grew up because they're larger than usual numbers of deaf people. The percentages are still small, but they're larger than what you would expect, like 6 times the deaf, 10 times the deaf population.
You got one back home.
Yes.
Nunu sign language.
Well, everywhere sign language.
No,
right?
No, but this is this is one community in Arnhem Land where there's a disproportionately high number of deaf Aboriginal people.
Yes. And also, yeah.
So that's different from the other indigenous sign.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Traditional sign versus spam. That's what I was trying to establish, the difference between traditional sign, which
these are separate sign languages.
Yeah. And I think there's much more work in Australia to be done because we don't know, because there are many different groups, as we know,
yeah.
We're starting to look into this, the intergenerational transmission.
Sorry.
Oh, it's interesting. I was listening.
Sorry, just ask one more question / suggestion. I wonder whether there was any interest among the deaf groups and the deaf people that you met in the documentation process, and whether it would be possible for, say, one of those groups to kind of take it on as their project.
Right.
That might help a lot of the, apart from anything else, it would help with some of the methodological kind of issues.
I agree, yeah. If I can get that established and actually start training people, that would be fantastic, yeah.
Well, thank you very much. That's very interesting. There seems to be a break now here, so the next stop will be a